Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York. Buckle up. Things may be coming to a head in Special Counsel Jack Smith's classified documents investigation this week, with a series of potential developments that suggest that Smith could be on the verge of making some history, perhaps making Donald Trump the first former president to be indicted with a federal crime. NBC News is reporting this. The federal grand jury that has been hearing evidence in the Justice Department's investigation of former President Trump's handling of classified documents is expected to meet again this coming week in Washington. Now, that's according to multiple people familiar with the investigation. Prosecutors working for Special Counsel Jack Smith have been presenting the grand jury with evidence and witness testimony for months, but activity appeared to have slowed in recent weeks. That was based on observations at the courthouse and through sources. In another major sign that that investigation could be close to wrapping up, Trump's legal team was spotted at the Justice Department today. You can see them right there on your screen, leaving shortly before noon. This was weeks after they had requested a meeting with Merrick Garland to discuss this case. It is unclear who they met with at DOJ, but the Wall Street Journal reports that they were there, quote, to argue against any indictment of the former president over his handling of classified documents at his Mar-a-Lago resort. As the meeting was underway, our friend, CBS's Robert Costa, reported this, quote, Trump's lawyers are expected to raise concerns about how prosecutors have handled attorney-client questions during the grand jury. But there is no sign the special counsel is going to waver from how he and his team have handled the crime fraud exception. Questions of attorney-client privilege are central to this case, and here's why. You will recall that earlier this year, the special counsel, Jack Smith, went to a judge and invoked what is known as the crime fraud exception, claiming that there was probable cause to believe that Donald Trump had used his lawyer to help commit a crime. Now, a judge bought it. He sided with Smith and he compelled Trump attorney Evan Corker to testify and provide evidence without that shield of attorney-client privilege preventing him from doing so, and thus providing details about his interactions with the ex-president. There's brand new reporting today on what some of that evidence is that Corcoran handed over to Jack Smith. Notes that he took of his conversations with his client, the one and only Donald Trump, from the New York Times. Quote, turning on his iPhone one day last year, the lawyer, Evan Corcoran, recorded his reflections about a high-profile new job representing former President Donald Trump in an investigation into his handling of classified documents. Incomplete sentences and a narrative tone that sounded as if it had been ripped from a novel. Corcoran recounted in detail a nearly month-long period of the documents investigation. That is according to two people familiar with the matter. The New York Times reporting gives us a glimpse into what is in those audio notes. They explain why they could completely cripple Trump's defense in any prosecution. Quote, in an early scene in his account, Corcoran describes meeting Trump at Mar-a-Lago last spring to help him handle a subpoena that had just been issued by a federal grand jury in Washington, seeking the return of all classified material in the possession of his presidential office. After pleasantries, according to a description of the recorded notes, Trump asked Corcoran if he had to comply with the subpoena. Corcoran told him that he did. And this is all on tape. New developments in the final stages, perhaps, of the investigation into Donald Trump's handling of classified documents is where we begin today with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Politico national correspondent and MSNBC contributor Betsy Woodruff Swan is back. Former top Justice Department official and current MSNBC legal analyst Andrew Weissman is back. Also joining us, former FBI counterintelligence agent Pete Strzok. And here at the table for the hour, Democratic strategist and director of the public policy program at Hunter College, Basil Smigel. Andrew Weissman, you've just issued a tantalizing and newsworthy tweet in your own right with your credentials, with your relationships, and your expertise. I'm going to read it to our viewers. Quote, a zillion stories about Trump case, but bottom line is that he's getting charged and it will be in D.C. and this week. Open issues are whether others may be charged and whether they will be in D.C. or Florida. Please explain.
Sure. Well, first, it is really typical to see what we are seeing in terms of Donald Trump's counsel going to the Department of Justice. We saw the same thing when we were looking at the Manhattan DA's office. That is that prosecutors in cases like this, where there's no need to nab the defendant because they're in the middle of committing a crime or a violent crime or they're fleeing, they give defense counsel an opportunity to be heard. And to make any and all legal, factual, discretionary arguments as to why there should not be charges. And so here, especially if the reporting is about the attorney-client privilege, I mean, that's just never going to stop anybody from finding that the charges are appropriate, because here a judge has approved what it is that happened here. And I should point out, the current Solicitor General of the United States worked on the Mueller investigation, where the exact same thing was done in front of the exact same judge. So I just think that's going to be a loser. It may be something they're arguing in order to make a political point later. And so we really are seeing what I always view as the harbinger of, cases being brought. So the exact same thing happened in Manhattan, which is you see defense lawyers making an argument and then you see charges. The open issue is where the charges will be brought and who, if anyone, may be charged alongside Donald Trump. In other words, there may be conspirators. There may be those charges may be ones that can only be brought in a different jurisdiction because there's constitutional rules about where charges can be brought. I should say, in spite of my tweet, it is conceivable that Donald Trump would be charged in Florida and not D.C. I don't think that'll be the case, but I do think the one thing I'm pretty confident of is that we are going to see charges with respect to the classified documents case. And it seems by all accounts it's going to be this week, because I think that the DOJ will feel that internal pressure to move this along.
I have 378 follow-up questions, but I'll start with one. What I think you're articulating is that the auspices of the meeting to battle the piercing of attorney-client privilege may be a Trump-driven errand, because the matter's been adjudicated. The matter in secret, not something we saw. Evidence has already been provided that was strong enough that a judge said, oh, yeah, oops, yes, crimes, yes, crimes, yes, crimes. And that's why we get to see everything. Is that how I understand what you're articulating?
Yes. And Nicole, it's really important to remember. So there is a model for this having been done with respect to Paul Manafort and Rick Gates in the special counsel investigation. Before Beryl Howell ruled in that case, Manafort and Gates and their counsel all had an opportunity to be heard. In other words, this isn't something that's done ex parte. They all get an opportunity to argue why the government is wrong. So this has been fully litigated. There's no question that Donald Trump, as the person who holds the potential privilege, would have that opportunity to be heard. And so this has all been vetted by a federal judge, a respected federal judge. And I'm confident if it follows the exact same plan that was done and the reasoning that was done by the judge in the Manafort case, this is not one where the DOJ is going to second guess what Jack Smith did or what the judge did, because it's all been vetted. So that just seems like a real loser. I think they may have made arguments based on venue. I mean, I know that sounds like a really weak tea in terms of we're going to get charged, but can we please do it in Florida, not in D.C.? And I do think that Florida would be a better venue for Trump than D.C. So he may have made that argument as well.
What does it mean that a grand jury in Florida has heard evidence? Does that, us non lawyers were spitballing, which is always dicey, and wondered if perhaps some of the early reporting about how every single person at Mar-a-Lago, including, you know, maintenance staff and including people that work on the grounds, has been interviewed, that maybe it was a convenience, but maybe that's a crazy, stupid way of thinking about it. Could that grand jury there have been convened for something else?
So just, you know, Nicole, you shouldn't feel too bad because a lot of lawyers do a lot of spitballing also, and we can be get it wrong as well. So, you know, it's not unique to non-lawyers to be doing this sort of educated guessing. I think there's sort of two possibilities with respect to what we're hearing about there also being a Florida grand jury. One possibility is that all of the charges against Donald Trump will be brought in Florida. It seems by all accounts there would be venue for all of the charges. And just to be a little bit of a nerd, the Constitution requires that a crime be charged where it occurred. But a lot of times crimes happen in many, many jurisdictions. For instance, if you have a conspiracy charge, that could happen in many, many different locations. And any one of those would satisfy the Constitution for being brought in a location where the crime occurred. But there's no question, I think, that from everything we've heard, that Florida would be a place where all of the charges could be brought. And D.C., it's not clear that in Washington, D.C., all of the charges could be brought, but I think some of them could be brought there. The other possibility is that the reason we're hearing about a Florida grand jury is that it's not so much with respect to Donald Trump, but it may be with respect to other people. So, for instance, if an underling like Mr. Nauta, who is somebody who allegedly moved boxes for Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago, if he made false statements to the government in Florida, that is something that may be uniquely be charged in Florida, so that if the government is thinking, I'm going to charge Donald Trump in D.C., they may at the same time decide that they want to charge Mr. Nauta to put more pressure on him, and also because he should be held to account if he lied to the government, and that charge may be brought in Florida. So that might be a second reason for why we're hearing that there may be grand jury activity in that state.
All right, Andrew, I have one more for you. It felt like Jim Comey's, you know, payout from the political grave, Lordy, there are tapes. As Michael Cohen before him and Don McGahn with his copious notes and the notes of his note taker, Annie Donaldson, who became the narrator of volume two of the Mueller report. Trump has another lawyer who didn't just take notes, but who narrated a, you know, novel-like version of his month-long legal service for Trump. Is that normal?
No. So, you know, when I think about the lawyers and the caliber of lawyers who have represented presidents of the United States, whether Democrats or Republicans, I don't think that is normal. That's not either the caliber of the lawyers that we've seen. In other words, usually these are the people who are the most revered and at the very top of their profession. Think David Kendall or Bob Bauer or Kathy Rumler, people who are just, you know, at the very top of their legal game. And there's no reason, whether you're representing George Bush or Barack Obama or Joe Biden, to be taking copious notes because you're concerned that your client or the president of the United States or the former president of the United States is going to be lying about what happened. But we know from starting, as you mentioned, with Don McGahn, that if you are representing Donald Trump, it is a good practice to take notes so that you have a memorialization of what you did do and what you didn't do to protect yourself from these kinds of claims. So it is really abnormal. And these are lawyers who realize what they need to do in order to protect their bar license with respect to a very difficult client.
Betsy Woodruff Swan, NBC News is reporting that Trump's attorneys spotted at the Justice Department today. I'll read you what we have. James Trustee John Rowley and Lindsay Halligan were at the Justice Department and met with a group of Justice Department officials that did not include Attorney General Merrick Garland or Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco. The team was first spotted by CBS News and then was seen emerging from the building just before noon. What do we know about what happened in there?
We know that about a week ago, one of the lawyers who participated in this meeting, Jim Trustee, telegraphed something of an agenda for what he was hoping to talk about with Merrick Garland himself. Obviously, that conversation didn't happen, but Trustee said in a TV interview that he hoped to sort of level accusations of prosecutorial misconduct, that he wants to claim prosecutors working for Jack Smith's team have engaged in problematic behavior that should shape DOJ's charging decision in this case. Of course, it certainly seems like Garland, Lisa Monaco, and the other very top brass at the Justice Department did not decide to engage with that overture that Trustee made publicly. And my sense in general is that when defense attorneys are making overtures like this publicly, it's because private outreach has not proven fruitful the way that they would hope it to be. That said, of course, this meeting also comes as the investigation by all available public evidence appears to be zooming toward its conclusion. We know, therefore, one of the things that Trustee has said he wanted to talk about, but of course, there's no question that Trump's lawyers would be trying to glean as much information as possible from their DOJ interlocutors about what the specifics are of a case that DOJ could be building against their client.
Betsy, I have some of that public bluster, shall we describe it? Let me show that to everybody.
The angle they're pushing on the obstruction is to try to create some sort of daylight between Joe Biden's possession of documents and President Trump's. And it's not going to work. I mean, they have literally put in everybody to grand jury you could imagine. They don't respect any privilege that President Trump holds. And it's desperately trying to find an obstruction angle that just isn't there.
President Trump, to my understanding, declassified everything. The FBI's withholding of information and lack of transparency is crazy. It's honestly, it may be the first step to tyranny.
They are very selective in terms of what they want out there. And we definitely want to know what they're claiming they have as evidence. So the withholding of information is essentially controlling the flow of information. And that is the first step to tyranny.
They've got their talking points down. But I guess the problem with Lindsay and Jim's arguments is that their client has already contradicted them in public. The angle on the obstruction case is being argued by Donald Trump, who said, quote, they're mine, and end quote, we've got the Presidential Act. And then Lindsay's argument seems to be that he declassified them, which is also contradicted by Trump, saying, I can't show you this, it's classified. I mean, how do they contend with their own, you know, rear ends being out there contradicted by their own client, much more public and high profile appearances?
There's just been something of a spaghetti noodles against the wall approach from Trump compared to his lawyers when it comes to the explanation that he and his team have been trying to give as it pertains to these documents. At least on Trump's part, it certainly appears that any possible explanation is one that he's willing to bring forward and hope that one of the basket of occasionally contradictory explanations he's been making is something that DOJ officials will decide is persuasive or that a jury will decide is persuasive. The other thing, of course, here that's important is that while Trump's lawyers are arguing that there was a violation of an attorney-client privilege, as Andrew Weissman pointed out, as you pointed out, the attorney-client privilege matter was adjudicated. This was not something that DOJ did unilaterally or would have been able to do unilaterally. Trump's lawyers and Trump already got their day in court. It was under seal, but they had that day in court, and a judge sided with DOJ, at least in a limited extent, as it came to this privilege question. So the fact that Trump's lawyers are now speaking out publicly to raise their concerns about what DOJ did, it's not going to have any bearing on the legality, at least as far as Judge Beryl Howell ruled when it came to these matters covered by attorney-client privilege, allegedly.
Pete Strzok, let me read you some more of this New York Times reporting. Times reports this. The issue of who moved the boxes into and out of the storage room and why has become one of the central parts of Mr. Smith's investigation. Prosecutors have focused much of their attention on Walt Nauta, an aide to Mr. Trump, who took part in moving boxes, and on another Mar-a-Lago employee, Carlos de Oliveira, a maintenance worker who helped Mr. Nauta. Mr. Corcoran's notes provide some details about Mr. Nauta's involvement in the search. They say, for instance, that Mr. Nauta unlocked the storage room door for Mr. Corcoran, according to people familiar with them. They also say that Mr. Nauta brought Mr. Corcoran some tape so that he could seal in a folder the classified documents he found in preparation for giving them to prosecutors. What do you make of just the sort of tip of the iceberg that we're learning about? Isn't just in written notes, but narrated by Mr. Corcoran.
Well, Nicole, I think it is important for a couple of reasons. One, it points to a set of activities that are beyond just one person, potentially, that it was not just Donald Trump who engaged in this potentially illegal activity, but that he worked with others in the conduct of this illegal activity. Now, that's important because simply obstruction is a standalone criminal count, but it's also important in the context of when the Department of Justice has charged mishandling cases in the past. And look, for 20 years, I investigated dozens upon dozens of mishandling investigations, prosecuted, worked with prosecutors on taking several of those to trial and obtaining convictions. But every time DOJ has taken a mishandling case to trial, it's usually in the context of mishandling where it was willful and intentional behavior, where there are large, large amounts of classified information, when there was some indication of disloyalty to the United States, or where there was some evidence of obstruction. So in this case, where you see those actions, certainly of Walt Nauta, and I completely agree with Andrew that I'm very curious to see if there is within certainly this Florida grand jury potential conspiracy charges that are coming out of Florida incorporating Walt Nauta and whether or not he was working with Donald Trump to obstruct justice. But again, it's important, one, because it informs whether or not DOJ should charge 793 or mishandling of classified information as they have in the past. I think the facts clearly support doing so, given what DOJ has done for the past 60, 70 plus years. And then separately, it's also important to that question of, is someone, are others beyond Donald Trump facing criminal charges coming down the pike here in the next week or two? I trust Andrew's sources. I don't know if it's going to be this week or in the next 2 or 3 weeks ahead, but I do anticipate that we are going to see charges.
Pete, when you and Andrew talk about conspiracy, do you see outward facing signs that they're looking at conspiracy in the obstruction prong, if we can talk about this as a two-pronged probe, the way we did the Mueller probe? Because I remember at the time a lot of reporting from Betsy and outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post about some of the decisions forced upon White House officials as Trump sought to fire Mueller and as Trump told people to lie to Mueller, that there was always a little bit of concern about being part of a conspiracy to obstruct that investigation. Or do you see the outlines of a potential conspiracy prosecution on the mishandling as well?
Well, Nicole, I think they're tied together. I mean, again, this is where we're all guessing a little bit based on what we're seeing reported in the press, and we're not inside Jack Smith's investigation seeing the information that he has. But it seems clear from a lot of the reporting about what went on the days surrounding the issuance of the subpoena by the Department of Justice that there were things done to get in the way and hinder the inventory, first that Evan Corcoran was doing, and then secondly, to hide things potentially from being turned over to the Department of Justice. So the question is, who said what to whom? You know, presumably from what we know about Evan Corcoran's notes, it was not something that he was encouraging the president. In fact, you played that little snip where Trump astoundingly said, hey, do I have to follow the law, essentially? And Corcoran said, yeah, boss, you do. But then the question becomes, did people this some indication that he was waved off from searching anywhere other than the basement storage room? Who waved him off? I mean, I don't think Walt Nauta is going to be the person to do it. it, but then, you know, did NADA play more than a, you know, just kind of a functionary role in bringing up the boxes and returning him? Did he see Trump taking material out? Did he have any sort of conversation with Evan Corcoran where he told him, don't worry about it, it's only the basement stuff? You know, some question about that third person who may have helped NADA apparently load or move boxes. You know, that's some question about, you know, was he just trying to help out, had no idea what he was doing other than move these five boxes from here to there. But I do think, again, there are two separate things. There's potentially a standalone obstruction charge, and then certainly obstruction, that obstructive actions, those play a role in trying to determine the whether or not to bring a mishandling charge. So they're intertwined, in my opinion, and I would not be surprised to see separate counts, to see a standalone, likely, in my opinion, 793 count, and then a separate conspiracy obstruction count.
All right, there's so much more to ask all of you. I want to bring Basil in on all of this as well. We have to sneak in a quick break first, but we will get to that, as well as there's a model prosecution memo for Trump classified documents that needs translation from the experts. We'll have them do that for us. Also, later in the broadcast, we'll get to GOP hopeful Nikki Haley, who last night attempted to out MAGA, I guess you could say, the growing field of competition in the Republican presidential primary, trying to blame trans youth in sports as the reason teen girls are contemplating suicide. That really happened. Another lie on the right, a group where cruelty is most certainly, most definitely, most brazenly the point. And later in the broadcast, the twin investigations into the ex-president's efforts to overturn the 2020 election, how both of those probes are today drilling down on just how many people knew that he really, really, really had lost the presidency and told him so. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
We're back with Betsy Woodruff-Swan, Andrew Weissman, Pete Strzok, and Basil Smichel. So, Basil, as you can imagine, Trump was active today on his social media platform. And I'll read you part of what he had to say. It was in all caps, which I think at this point signals a degree of agitation. Quote, how can DOJ possibly charge me? Who did nothing wrong? Not a question. I think he means, I don't know what he means there. When no other presidents, it's an oddly placed punctuation mark, were charged. It goes on and on. I'll spare our viewers the rest of the rant. But he clearly got some readout of this meeting at DOJ that he didn't like.
And you've talked about the bluster of his team. What is his team trying to do? Push blame onto Joe Biden? Well, Joe Biden did the same thing a couple of weeks ago. When I first heard NADA's name, I said, be prepared to hear his name more often, because I could see the team trying to shift blame there as well. But I also always go back to the reporting from last week. Got to go to glasses again. From that Washington Post article that said the details suggest a greater breadth and specificity to the instances of possible obstruction. And again, what that shows me is that the sheer, as a literally breadth of this incident, it makes it more and more unlikely that you can easily dismiss it from the point of view of the voter, for example. And it makes it less likely that he can do the same, although he will try. It makes it less and less likely that he can do the same because there are too many people involved, too much activity that went too far too long. And you know, as we think about this, as I think about this, I wonder, are we going to see a Comey-like moment? Are we going to see a moment where the potential indictment, an arrest, being brought out in handcuffs like we may have seen in Alvin Bragg? We didn't get to see that in the New York case. But is there going to come a point where all of this really does impact how the voter sees Donald Trump that is already sort of bought into him? Will this sully their view of him? As we are approaching a debate in August and the primary starting in February of next year.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a static answer. I think most Republicans and some pundits will say there's nothing he can do. Well, we don't know that because this has never happened before. And there are still a lot of self-fashioned national security whatever they call themselves in the Republican Party, who, if Trump is charged with violating the Espionage Act, may think Tim Scott or Nikki Haley or Ron DeSantis are just as, you know, authoritarian adjacent without the violation of the Espionage Act.
Well, that's exactly right. And the challenge there for any of those candidates, can I stay in long enough? Can I raise enough money to actually be able to
Smith to go fast, too.
Go fast. Can I actually get at him on a debate stage in time for it to make a difference?
Okay, Andrew Weissman, I am riveted by everything everyone says, but I'm fixated on your tweet. Tell me if there is something at a process level that is, you know, like the whistle that only a dog hears. Like, is there something that you have seen, or is it really just this meeting with the defense team at DOJ that makes you so confident? You choose your words pretty carefully on this show.
So before the Bragg case, I had said to everyone, pay attention for and listen for any information that defense lawyers were being called in to have their opportunity to be heard, because that is a sign of the very last thing that will happen. If you are not proposing charges, there is no reason for defense counsel to come in and make a presentation. You've already internally decided not to go forward. Now, it is conceivable that defense counsel comes in and says something that you didn't, something new, something you haven't understood, some fact that is going to change your view. I just think in this case, that is so unlikely for somebody as experienced as Jack Smith, where also the Mar-a-Lago case, as you've noted, I mean, the facts are so overwhelming that this is something that defense lawyers have an obligation to make these arguments, but it's very unlikely to change anything. So, again, there would be no reason to have the meeting if there weren't going to be potential charges, and it's extremely unlikely that defense counsel is going to say something that is new or novel that will cause somebody to essentially overrule Jack Smith. And remember, the standard for the Department of Justice to overrule Jack Smith is that essentially it's so beyond the pale. And here, I actually think when you look at what the facts are, it would actually be a violation of the rule of law for Donald Trump not to be charged. I mean, just last week, an Air Force officer was sentenced to 3 years in prison for doing far less than what Donald Trump appears to have done. So that's the reason why I think that if you believe in the rule of law and you're the Department of Justice, there are going to be charges here.
And Pete Strzok, there is something I think even more granular, if you talk to national security folks, especially on the intelligence side, that if you would like to preserve the prerogative to stay on offense in prosecuting classified documents cases and to protect state secrets, and some of those prosecutions are very, very difficult. You and Andrew know better than me. You can't create a second standard.
No, that's absolutely right. And Nicole, I can tell you several instances where we were investigating people, prosecuting people, and their attorneys would come in and plead to DOJ that, hey, I want the Petraeus deal, right? They looked at what the department did in other cases, and they said, look, you have created a precedent. I want that deal for my client. So it absolutely, I mean, Andrew is 100% right. The facts that we know, I mean, and there may be a dozen plus things we have no idea about, but just simply the things that have been reported out clearly place this into the category of what DOJ has prosecuted in the past. No question about it. It's not close. And so, you know, all this crap that Trump's attorneys are throwing against the wall, the things that he's tweeting about, fly in the face of the precedent. And the responsible course of action is to bring charges. You know, I think regardless when it comes, I would expect, you know, much like Fani Willis has announced, you know, the end of July, beginning of August to local law enforcement to be aware. Mm-hmm. I suspect that if an indictment is coming, at some point, DOJ or the FBI will reach out to the Secret Service, will reach out to local law enforcement, because simply the announcement of charges might bring, you know, violent protests or any protesters, and you'd want to give law enforcement a heads up about that. Now, I don't suspect DOJ will do that prior to a grand jury returning a true bill, but I think there is some chance that the very first things we may hear from, if and when their charges are sort of leaks out from the sort of administrative security coordination that is going to go on in the context of an indictment.
Betsy, there's such a remarkable body of evidence in public view now. There's the months and months and months of correspondence between NARA and Trump before DOJ and the FBI are even involved. Then there's the extraordinary release of the application for court-approved search of Mar-a-Lago. Then there's all that was released during the, whatever we call it, special master process of last fall. I know that feels like 11 years ago, but it was just last fall. And then there's the tapes. I mean, so much of what we're learning has been put before the grand jury is what just persuaded another jury in a different case in a civil instance to say, oh, yeah, liable. And that's Trump in his own voice, you know, ruffling papers. You know, whether it was a Chick-fil-A menu or classified documents. I think none of us knows that as we sit here today. But he expressed clear knowledge of a declassification process. And he articulated that the document he was ruffling hadn't been declassified. So he clearly was signaling that there were things he took that were classified and things he took that he had not declassified. He's also on tape over and over and over again, even when given the opportunity by his closest media allies like Sean Hannity, who said, you would never take things out of secure storage. He's like, yeah, I can. Yeah, I did. Yeah, I would. I mean, there's been no denial of the criminal conduct under scrutiny.
Yeah, and I think what I always think about as a reporter and sort of the job of reporters is to think about what don't we know. There's this enormous body of reporting documents, known unassailable facts about what happened in the months after Trump left the White House as it involves these highly sensitive, highly important documents. And then the next question is, what about all the information we don't yet know? We haven't seen a transcript yet of the recording of that conversation that Trump had where he refers to U.S. military plans related to Iran. We haven't seen a language that he used specifically to talk about what he knew regarding the way the declassification process was supposed to work. And just as importantly, why that process mattered, why it wasn't just a sort of a ticky-tacky box checking process, but how it actually related to keeping people in this country safe. Those are all pieces of information. Those are all details that Jack Smith and his investigators have that we in the public don't have yet, despite tons and tons of excellent reporting on what Jack Smith himself has gotten, as well as what reporters have learned independently of Jack Smith and his grand jury just hoovering up information. And so that's the next big question. How much of this mystery information, how much of these known unknowns are we going to learn about in the coming weeks and months? And of course, how much of that information in context could change the way we think about the criminal exposure Trump as well as any of his allies could have? And what's beyond questioning is that we're getting closer to having a lot more daylight in terms of that whole known unknown space.
As everyone's talking, I have this flashback to the Republican convention in 16 and the chant led by indicted, admitted, pardoned felon Mike Flynn, lock her up. Right. Remember what that was about?
Absolutely.
This is crazy that here's where we are.
But that's my point about the Comey moment. You know, if you think about that letter and the impact it had on the election. Is an indictment of Donald Trump going to have the same impact on not just the Republican Party, but on the election? There are a lot of differences, but the question is, digging into Andrew's point a little bit, it's not politics if you charge him. It's playing politics if you don't.
Correct.
And if the voter feels that we're at a point where all of this is in front of us, and you still cannot hold this man accountable, I'm sure it will gin up his base, but my fear is that it will dampen any other voter that wants to, you know, engage their civil right to participate in the process. And then he will have won. Whether he wins the election or not, he would still be winning. And that's really my fear in all of this.
All right, Betsy Woodruff-Swann, Andrew Weissman, Pete Strzok, thank you so much for starting us off on all of these threads. We're so grateful. Basil sticks around. Up next for us, Republicans all around the country are racing to enact laws and spread misinformation targeting the LGBTQ community, creating fear among millions of families. What can be done about it? We'll have that conversation next.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
At a town hall event last night, when she was given an opportunity to talk to voters about issues front and center around the kitchen table for all of us Americans, Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley opted to attack transgender women in sports. The former South Carolina governor was asked to define the term woke, and we're going to play her response since she is running to serve as the president. But in it, she falsely and rather bizarrely blames transgender women in sports for the increased rates of suicidal thoughts among teen girls.
The idea that we have biological boys playing in girls' sports, it is the women's issue of our time. My daughter ran track in high school. I don't even know how I would have that conversation with her. How are we supposed to get our girls used to the fact that biological boys are in their locker rooms? And then we wonder why a third of our teenage girls seriously contemplated suicide last year? We should be growing strong girls, confident girls.
Just fact check here. Trans women playing sports is not what the CDC or any pediatric association that covers teenage girls and studies their suicidal thoughts has ascribed that rise to. CDC has found no evidence of that. Two things don't have anything to do with one another, at least as far as the science and the data shows. And for people that Haley is blaming for society's problem, that actual number that she's talking about is minuscule. This is reporting from Newsweek. Let me read it to you. Quote, privacy laws make it tough to identify the exact number of transgender athletes competing in public school sports. But researcher and medical physicist Joanna Harper estimates that the number cannot exceed 100 nationwide. 100 people. 100 trans athletes. And while the threat of transgender people is a real thing on the right, it is a real boogeyman, they are really, really making it something that matters to all Republicans. It's a narrative that is being ginned up and turbocharged by Republicans. In Florida, a new law signed by Republican governor and presidential candidate Ron DeSantis that banned gender-affirming care for minors is cutting off access to that kind of care for adults as well. Joining our conversation and coverage is Kelly Robinson, president of the Human Rights Campaign. Basil's still with us. Kelly, we tried to report out some of the facts, but share anything that I missed.
Look, if we want to talk about women's sports, let's talk about the real issues, right? Like pay equity. If we want to talk about the mental health crisis, and let's talk about the real issues, like 40% of trans teens considering suicide, one in five attempting it. But what let's not do is actually use this trope to attack the trans community. Because right now, what we're seeing is MAGA Republicans and Nikki Haley leading an attack against the trans community, against LGBTQ plus people for political purposes only. This is not what the majority of Americans care about or what they want. They are creating a false crisis when there are real crises to address.
Kelly, do you think that when people react or clap, I mean, I imagine for all the Republicans to be heading down this path, they have to think that it works or see evidence that it works. Do you think any of them know that we're talking about 100 maybe student athletes?
I mean, that's a sad part. We're only talking about a small group of folks. And at the end of the day, we're talking about kids, about children. And what we're seeing play out is this playbook of using political attacks to target children. And I also want to really draw the connections here, because the attack that Nikki Haley said out loud in that town hall is directly connected to the hundreds of anti-LGBTQ plus bills that have been introduced across the country. It's directly connected to the targeting of corporations like Target, the places where we shop and where we live. And it's directly connected to the increase of physical threats and violence against the community. Right now, one in five of every hate crime is perpetrated on the basis of anti-LGBTQ plus bias. They are sowing fear and hate against our people at a time when we need hope, aspirations, and solutions to address the crises at hand.
You know, Basil, there's also an incredible body of reporting that should be front and center. It is a kitchen table issue, and I think it's specific to teen girls, and there's a lot of research that what they see on their phones, specifically algorithms that put them in a constant loop of eating disorder content or whatnot. I think 60 Minutes has some brand new reporting on this, is a real problem. So if you're going to stand on a podium, if you're going to be broadcast, if you're going to be platformed, and you're going to talk about not just teen suicide, which is a horrific thing that we should talk about. We should come to the table. To lie about what is the greatest correlation is a real disservice. We should be talking about online content.
Yeah, absolutely right. I work with a lot of students who are very, very concerned about that. And they're the generation that you would expect to engage more on social media, but they're actually starting to pull back because of those very same concerns. And I want to focus on another point that was made about danger. Because one of the things that I sense from a lot of young people in the LGBTQ community is isolation. Mm. And that isolation has manifested in so many ways that there are students that I've come to work with who came out to their parents, and then the parents don't even attend their college graduation. And then we have to then step in and essentially be their support system in addition to, you know, what they should be getting from family members or friends.
And so the attacks don't make it easier on the family either.
That's exactly right. Those attacks don't make it easier. That isolation becomes deeper. And we should be in the business of supporting these young people and not pushing them into harm's way. And just very quickly, 1992, here in New York City, after some attacks against African-Americans, in a time when the highest, the death rate among men from 25 to 44 was mainly caused by AIDS. And at that point, we were talking about more inclusive curriculum, a rainbow curriculum, if you will. Mm-hmm. And look what's happened since then. We've gotten the pharmaceutical community, healthcare community. There's been so much protest to try to make change. So anyone now looking to thwart all of that progress is only looking to sow anger, isolation, and fear and danger.
It just feels like we come back to this on books. We come back to this all the time. We're moving in the wrong direction. We have to sneak in a quick break. No one's going anywhere. We will all be right back. We're back with Kelly Robinson and Basil Smichel. Kelly, my question for you is about the facts. I saw the coverage of Nikki Haley, and I got online this morning and was reading about the size of the trans population. I think it's about 1.2 million, according to two newspaper sources, New York Times and the Washington Post. And then I dug into the student athlete population. It's about 100. And then I looked to see if Republicans were upset about all trans athletes, and they're not. The only public statements I read about are student athletes that identify as women, as girls, and compete. So I wonder what you think can be done on the fact piece of this, that they're obsessing, that they're endangering, that they're pumping up and turbocharging with vitriol a political fight, with the facts getting so far left behind from the political rhetoric. How do we sort of shrink that gap?
I mean, it's sad, really. We have to name it for what it is. You know, some of these laws, these trans sports bans, when they've gone into place, are impacting less than a handful of students, of young people, of children in that state. Is that really where our politicians should be focusing their energies when there are real crises at hand, like gun violence are impacting kids every day, like real mental health crises are impacting our kids? We have to name this for what it is. And we also have to be clear that the emergent generation, Generation Z, they get it. They get it more than we do. One in five of Gen Z identifies as a member of the LGBTQ plus community. This is a trend that is not going to stop. We have to create welcoming schools and welcoming environments for these kids to thrive. That's all of our responsibilities.
Right. And that isn't, I think people will look at us when the history is written and say, what did you do? What did you do to protect the trans kid? And not just the kid, but to Basil's point, to support the family, trying to support their kids. A really important conversation. Kelly and Basil, thank you so much. We have been juggling some breaking news in the break, and there is some of it of the Jack Smith variety straight ahead. Don't go anywhere. We will all be right back. Hi again, everyone. It's now 5 o'clock in New York. We come on the air with some breaking news. That meeting we told you about last hour between Donald Trump's defense attorneys and DOJ officials? Well, guess who was in there? Special counsel Jack Smith was among those in the meeting. This comes as NBC News is reporting that the grand jury investigating the former president's handling of classified documents is expected to meet again this week, putting that tweet and conversation with our friend Andrew Weissman in a whole new light. Reminder, he told us, bottom line, Trump is getting charged, and it will be in D.C. and this week. It's where we begin the hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Former lead investigator for the January 6th Select Committee, Tim Hafey, is back at the table. Also joining us, former acting U.S. Solicitor General and MSNBC legal analyst, Neil Katyal, is making his way to a camera. We're a minute early, so I think he will be here in a second. The editor of The Bulwark and MSNBC contributor, Charlie Sykes, is here. And Washington Post congressional investigations correspondent, Jackie Alamany, joins us. I hate to come on with a big bluster of breaking news and say, Jack Smith was there. What does that mean to a prosecutor? Because I'm sure your answer is, well, of course he was there.
Exactly. He's leading the investigation. Sure. He naturally would be there for a meeting with lawyers for the principal target of that investigation. I don't see his personal presence as significant. The fact, though, that he's meeting with counsel to the former president suggests they're right at the very end, as Andrew's tweet suggests, that there may have been a prosecutive decision, but they're just giving the Trump lawyers one opportunity to try to raise issues that might change that decision.
And one of the issues that the Trump legal team has raised in television interviews is this complaint about attorney-client privilege. But as Betsy Woodrow Swann and others have explained, that has been adjudicated. It didn't happen in public. But evidence has already been presented secretly to a judge who said, oh, yeah, that is adequate evidence that a crime was committed.
Exactly right. I mean, the chief judge for the D.C. District Court found that there was a crime fraud exception, which allowed the grand jury to hear evidence from Evan Corcoran, a lawyer for the former president, that trumps, so to speak, the attorney-client privilege. And that's very important evidence because, again, we've talked about this before. The whole ball game for Jack Smith is the president's intent. Did he know that this information was classified? Did he possess it? Nonetheless, that getting inside his head requires information from people with whom he spoke, including his lawyers.
I mean, you guys got as close as anyone has to Trump's attorneys in the White House. And even without saying much of anything, he said it all, right? Pat Cipollone in that interview, I think, with Congressman Schiff and Congresswoman Liz Cheney.
Very demonstrative.
Right? Yes. How impactful is it for a prosecutor to be completely behind that privilege?
It's really unusual. It almost never happens because it's really unusual that lawyers facilitate criminal conduct by their clients. Mm. I think Pat Cipollone was trying to prevent criminal conduct. Mm. Pat Cipollone also is an institutionalist who respects the office and was trying his best to protect the integrity of the White House counsel's office and not provide confidential communications. The grand jury and the special counsel have means that we did not have to push through that, right, to overcome that, to adjudicate those objections to privilege claims quickly, which Jack Smith and his team have done successfully. That's why they're getting stuff that we didn't get.
When you see what is public facing, and it now includes this, New York Times describes it as a narrative that sounds like it was a draft of a novel. This is Evan Corcoran describing his month of representing Donald Trump in the documents investigation. And if I'm right about when he came in, it was not when they were haggling with NARA. It was once the FBI was involved and there was a subpoena.
Yeah.
What do you think they have in that trove of audio notes?
It sounds to me like they have pretty strong evidence of intent. Right. They have evidence from President Trump's lawyer and now evidently from a recording where the president is acknowledging that he possesses information, documents that were not turned over to NARA, that are classified, and even intends to show them to people, might intend to actually use them in some way. So, right? Motive is not an element of a crime that a prosecutor has to prove, but it certainly helps juries understand motivation and intent. And it's always been curious here, like, why would the former president want to hold on to this stuff? What's the motive? Is he trying to monetize it? Is he trying to show off? Is it just hubris? Conversations that he had with his lawyer, and particularly this recording, may provide some window into the president's motivation for holding on to this stuff.
You're about as close as we can get to someone who thinks like Jack Smith. So I'm just asking for your expert analysis and for what you see that we don't see. But when you see that Jack Smith has that tape you're talking about, where he's ruffling papers and then says on the tape to an autobiographer of Mark Meadows, can't show you that it's classified. It seems that that no more can Trump say, oh, well, everything I took was declassified because I thought it and I took it. That's gone, right?
Yes, exactly right, Nicole. Prosecutors often are not just trying to affirmatively satisfy the elements of their case, but they're trying to simultaneously rebut possible defenses. Mm-hmm. So some defense that I declassified all this stuff seems pretty directly rebutted by something on tape where he says himself, I can't show you that it's classified, right?
Right.
Again, he's consciously playing offense and defense, wants to move the ball down the field by showing evidence that establishes the offense. But he also wants to try to anticipate defense's advice of counsel. I can declassify anything by providing evidence that would anticipatorily rebut that defense.
You also watched him as you investigated him and his conduct on January 6th move the goalposts, right? I mean, it was, you know, when the insurrection was bad all around, I didn't do it, I told them to go home, as it became his calling card politically, as his position is now to pardon the insurrectionists, his story changed, right? And he owns parts of it. It seems that the documents case, and frankly, the Russia investigation was the same thing. In the beginning, it was, I don't know, Vladimir Putin. By the end, it was like, it wasn't illegal. I mean, how do you see his shifting public pronouncements bolstering Jack Smith's case?
I think that is probably partly why they gave him an opportunity through counsel to come in and provide, finally, to the extent it exists, coherent, articulated possible defense. He has made contrary public statements. I can declassify anything. I didn't have anything. Hard to tell from his social media posts or his public statements or his speeches what the facts are from him. So they're giving an opportunity to Jim Trustee and to whomever else is representing the former president to articulate once and for all, what is your version of what occurred? We want to hear you before a final prosecutorial decision is made. That's pretty common that you give a defendant an opportunity in a white collar case, an opportunity to make that presentation before an indictment decision is made.
I am told that Neil Katyal has made his way to a camera. Neil, we want your take on everything that has transpired today. News of this audio memo, a month of audio diaries from Donald Trump's criminal defense attorney, as well as the news that just broke in the last 10 minutes that Jack Smith was in the meeting today with Trump's defense counsel.
Yeah, so, and sorry, I had some connections difficulty, so I haven't heard what
worth the wait. You start at the beginning. We want to hear your fresh take on all of it.
I'm holding my iPhone and trying to talk to you, Nicole.
I think in the pandemic, I did Seth Meyers that way, like moving around. You know, we're just to hear you and see you is all we need.
Well, you're 100 Seth Meyers. So, look, I think that, you know, what this meeting indicates to me is we are at the end of the Mar-a-Lago piece of the Jack Smith investigation. This is the kind of thing defense attorneys would try and do as a last ditch effort to try and meet with the prosecutor, try and talk them out of it, try and say, oh, you abused my client's rights and so on. But I think, you know, those kinds of claims, we've heard them before, are pretty much going to fall on deaf ears. I mean, the idea that the attorney-client privilege was violated here is exactly what was litigated before the district judge and then going up to our nation's second highest court, the D.C. Circuit, which rebuked that kind of idea. And so it pierced attorney-client privilege for those really highly respected judges to have done that in the Mar-a-Lago investigation tells me that they believed a serious crime had been committed and that the attorney was part of that situation. And so they needed to get that information to the prosecutors of what that attorney knew and what that attorney did and what that attorney saw. That is a rare, rare thing. You almost never see it in the law, but it occurs only in really grave circumstances. Here, all of those judges said this meets that criteria. So what I think we are looking at is really, truly, Nicole, a situation where all signs are indicating Donald Trump will be indicted by Jack Smith for the mishandling of classified information at Mar-a-Lago, as well as the obstruction of evidence and the obstruction of the investigation afterwards, hiding the boxes, dress rehearsals, all that kind of stuff.
Neil, that's such a declarative statement, especially coming from you, and it syncs up with what Tim and Andrew have said today. And again, short of Jack Smith sitting down at this table, you are the most trusted and expert people. So I'm just gonna push a little more and try to understand again what's obvious to you that may not be obvious to me or some of our viewers. When you see that the Wall Street Journal is reporting that some evidence has been before a grand jury convened in Florida, what does that indicate to you?
Well, I think that there's, you know, that makes sense that you have parts of the investigation that are Florida centered around Mar-a-Lago, the retention of the documents, the initial arrival of the documents, what Trump did with those documents when he heard the federal authorities were looking for them. That's all a Florida centric thing. But you also have a D.C. grand jury looking into this as well. And that, of course, you know, I think is underscored by Donald Trump's own admission at the CNN town hall last week, which was that he made the decision to declassify these documents in Washington, D.C. And why is that relevant, Nicole? It's relevant because prosecutors care a lot about venue. Where are you going to indict if you're going to indict? And here are there two possible places, Florida or D.C. With Trump saying that he made the decision in D.C., that makes the case for D.C. to look stronger. Of course, those D.C. judges have already had aspects of this case, including the attorney-client privilege aspects of this case already, so they're familiar with it. And, I don't think it's, you know, impossible to say Donald Trump isn't going to be indicted, but I think all the signs are indicating that he will be. And that squares with, I think, the experience that those of us who served in the Justice Department and national security positions have had, which is you can't take this classified information and this national defense information, mishandle it, lie about it, and then expect not to be indicted. It's one thing if you've made an innocent mistake about a document or something like that. It's an entirely different thing when, as it looks, there's been an orchestrated campaign to keep those materials away from federal investigators and the National Archives. That's what makes it so grave.
Yeah, I mean, Neil, I don't consume a ton of right-wing media content for my own mental health, but I consume enough to know that the most dangerous place to be is between Bill Barr and a camera when he's asked about Trump's criminal exposure on the Mar-a-Lago probe. I mean, it almost isn't even a purely partisan analysis that his grave legal exposure is squarely on the two prongs of the Mar-a-Lago case, both the mishandling of classified documents and the new public-facing evidence about his knowledge that things he had weren't declassified, his sort of intent to share it by rustling the papers around, as well as, you know, the obstructive acts have all been quite public. I mean, we have heard him say in interview after interview, they're mine. There's been investigative reporting about him wanting to swap this for that, all of it classified. I mean, how do you assess as we sit here today the strength of both prongs, the sort of underlying crime, if you will, of the mishandling of the classified documents, perhaps violations of the Espionage Act, as well as the incredibly brazen obstruction of that investigation?
Yeah, so even before Donald Trump opened his mouth, really, about this investigation, even before we knew about the dress rehearsals of moving the boxes of evidence, and even before we knew about the Iran tape that came out last week about the classified information and the ways in which it maintained classification after Trump brought it out of the Oval Office, even before all of that, Bill Barr was saying, as you point out, Nicole, this is a crime. This is a really serious threat to Donald Trump. And every piece of additional evidence, I think, makes that case stronger and stronger, which is why, again, national security professionals, I don't care if you're a Republican or Democrat or some other party, people who've handled this, they know this is not the way that this would be an indictment if it were anyone else but Donald Trump. And that's why I think Jack Smith, who's such a by-the-book prosecutor, is going to see it that way. So, look, I think that the mishandling of the information in the first place, maybe Trump's going to have a defense like, I wasn't involved, I was out of the loop, someone else packed this stuff up, and so on. But it's not the finding of the documents itself that, to me, is the most significant thing. It's that Trump's lying about an obstruction of the investigation, both before, during, and after it. That's where I think the prosecutors are going to have such a difficulty. It'd be one thing if you made an innocent mistake, you owned up to the mistake, you got the materials returned, and so on. You know, for heaven's sakes, this is some of our most serious national security information. People, you know, very well may have died or put their lives on the line to get this, both Americans and our allies around the world who generate this as part of Five Eyes and other intelligence programs. Mm-hmm. And we can't just kind of just excuse that, particularly, you know, in some ways, because it's so visible. It'd be one thing if nobody knew about it. But how, what kind of signal are we sending to our allies, to our spies around the world, if we don't prosecute this? That's how I think Jack Smith will look at it.
Yeah. I mean, to Neil's point, Tim, it always struck me as completely implausible that for the number of classified documents that they found that he had with him, and the excuse being, I declassified them all when I took them, that there was, I mean, clearly that was never true. And no one ever thought it was true, because there would have been an outcry from America's allies, from the intelligence agencies themselves, just based on the volume of stuff he had.
Look, there's a process that's in place to declassify information.
Right. Even with the power, you still have to go through a process.
Exactly right. And people weigh in as to how damaging it might be to national security. There's the substance of the information. There's also the sources and methods right. by which the information was obtained. That puts people in danger if something goes forth and a foreign adversary says, oh, that must have come from Mr. X, who now they think might be an asset or a spy. So it's really fraught to do this. The former president has said that he can declassify things just by thinking about it. Again, there's absolutely no authority for that assertion. He can't think about something and declassify it. It goes through, and it has to go through, as Neil points out, a process to evaluate the danger of declassification. None of that happened here.
Jackie Alemany, I am told that you have broken some new news under the headline, Lawyers Ask DOJ Not to Charge Donald Trump. Tell us what you're reporting.
Yeah, Nicole, I just want to say quickly, though, on the heels of what Tim just said, another bit of new reporting that we had this morning was actually, it's not just that tape. That makes up the body of evidence that Jack Smith has collected in terms of the classification practices. But the Department of Justice, in really what is the latest sign that they are nearing the end of wrapping up their investigation, has also subpoenaed the National Archives for any and all documents over the course of the 4 years of the Trump White House related to classification, anything classification related. So that involves how to safeguard documents, any training logs that show that, you know, these are the people that attended these you know, seminars on how to declassify information, or anything pertaining to the policies or lack thereof in the White House that can show, you know, these people, including former President Trump, knew the difference between classified things and declassified things, and that not everything in the White House was declassified by the power of Trump's mind. That being said,
that is so interesting. Let me just follow up with you. I mean, that seems to get at the same thing that Tim and the Select Committee sought to get at. Just because Trump asserted that he thought he won, you had his campaign manager, you had his campaign data guy, you had his campaign pollster, you had all of his campaign allies saying he lost, and we told him he lost. We went and investigated his lies, and we found out his lies were just that, lies. It seems that there is a pattern emerging that he says, I declassified it by thinking it. And one of the things Jack Smith is doing is trying to put some reporting or some evidence behind this idea that you're articulating, that he was briefed on this date. This person was in the room. Mark Meadows, who walked up to the residence, had been briefed 11 times, including on these 6 days, that they all knew there was a process for declassification. Is that right?
Yeah. And there is, like there has been with so many things, there is a paper trail there. Mm. You know, the National Archives has so far, according to our sources, produced thousands of documents and continue to produce those documents on a rolling basis to the Justice Department, although they've been told to hurry things up and wrap it up because, you know, what at least we have deduced that signifies is that it is, again, the latest sign that Jack Smith is trying to wrap up all of the evidence and make a decision. But as of today, as everyone has laid out, the Trump lawyers went into the Justice Department, and we have also confirmed that they did meet with Jack Smith and a handful of other top officials at the Justice Department, and essentially laid out the case for why they why their client Trump shouldn't be indicted. But I do want to caution. I know it seems like all signs that, you know, pointing to the fact that an indictment is imminent. I'm not necessarily sure that the grand jury being impaneled this week means that it's happening this week. There are a number of things that the grand jury could be doing. The lawyers can speak to this better, but we could be hearing from a new witness. We could be hearing from a witness who has now been immunized and compelled to testify. We could, the grand jury could be potentially seeing a new body of evidence, a new material that Smith and his investigators have found. So there are really a number of things that could happen today. You know, not just, I mean, happened this week, and it's not just, you know, the grand jury is going to vote on charges against the former president.
Jackie, do we know anything about how the lawyers felt when they left the meeting with Jack Smith? And again, my only evidence was that they may not have felt great, was that we are all students of Trump's responses and reactions. And his all caps, you know, grammatically incoherent tweet suggests it wasn't a great readout.
That is right, Nicole, and we do have a bit of reporting on that as well, that advisors to the former president do think that their client is ultimately going to be charged. It is just a matter of when, and that there wasn't any success necessarily that was had during this meeting.
Charlie Sykes, let me bring you in on this. A million different ways to say it, but, you know, the bleep just got real, right? I mean, Donald Trump knows it. We all know it. It seems to be a matter of when, at this point, not if, there's sufficient evidence should Jack Smith and Merrick Garland decide to indict Donald Trump for mishandling of classified documents, potentially an obstruction of that investigation.
Well, and I think that that's been made very clear by what Andrew said, what Tim said, and what Neil said, that it is, in fact, imminent. Look, you know, there are a lot of things that we don't know about this investigation. There are a lot of things that are, you know, still shrouded. But there are four things that we do know. We do know the federal judge has pierced the attorney-client privilege, which is extremely rare, because she believed that that evidence had suggested that there was a crime. That is a very, very big deal. That is a huge tell. We know that Jack Smith sat in on this meeting today. That is obviously as significant as the fact that, number three, the grand jury is meeting, and number four, as you just pointed out, what we also know is that Donald Trump is losing his mind on social media. I mean, all of these are scraps of evidence. We don't know what the prosecutor is going to do. We don't know what the charges will be, what the headline will be. But we do know that it's gotten very, very real. And all you need to do is track what's going on with those all cap screeds from Mar-a-Lago, because that's probably good an indication of whether or not the meeting went well or not. And I think we know what the answer is there.
You know, again, I think everyone is being careful to nod to what we don't know. I think after covering Mueller for 23 months, it was incredibly opaque. Your investigation was opaque until you decided to show us your work. What are you looking for when this becomes more public facing? What are your questions?
I think we have a lot of speculation about what was in the president's mind. We spent a lot of our time on the select committee trying to uncover evidence of whether the president was specifically aware of the lack of evidence of election fraud. Specific awareness in an indictment that alleges specific knowledge that this stuff was declassified, and again, intent maybe to do something with it. That's hard for a prosecutor to prove, evidence of state of mind. Prosecutor could issue a one-paragraph indictment with the elements of the statute, or he could issue a speaking indictment, which lays out in some detail some of the evidence or some of the facts that give rise to those charges. I think it'd be very interesting to see what the special counsel, if they do proceed with an indictment, do they do a speaking indictment that gives America a little bit more sort of meat on the bones of sorts, or do they issue a very cursory elements of the statute indictment, which just says, he violated this statute, and these are the elements of that statute.
Do you have a sense of which is more likely?
I mean, I think you could argue that there's a public interest in getting more information.
I mean, Mueller did the second, right?
Exactly right. I mean, I think prosecutors are mindful of the sort of magnitude of cases, that certain cases are more significant. There's a greater degree of public interest. That sort of suggests maybe a speaking indictment, mm-hmm. a little bit more meat on the bones than you normally see an indictment might make sense in a case like this.
Neil, you get the last word. What are you looking to be revealed if this goes to the next level, to a potential indictment of Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think the indictment will come in two parts, and I think it'll have more detail rather than less. I don't think they'll do what Bragg did in New York and kind of leave a lot for later, in part because of the public interest. And the two parts are, number one, the mishandling side, which I think is very straightforward, just about, you know, how the documents were picked up, discovered, and so on. But it's number two, the obstruction side, that I think I'm really going to be looking at, because it's the obstruction side in which this case appears not to be an ordinary mishandling of classified information case, but this is about thumbing your nose at the law, thumbing your nose at the national security apparatus, thumbing your nose at our intelligence professionals around the world, thumbing your nose at our allies. And when someone behaves in that way, if, you know, these reports about what Trump did are accurate, that's what, to me, will be the strength of the indictment. And that's where the ball game will be, and where Trump will face the most serious consequences.
That's so interesting. And I mean, I think, Neil, we talk so much about how Trump running for president makes this investigation more challenging. What you just articulated, the fact that Trump is running to be not just president, but the nation's commander in chief, makes this investigation the most important and central question to ask and answer ahead of that run. Neil, thank you for overcoming technical issues and otherwise we can't have these conversations without you. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Tim, Jackie, and Charlie are sticking around. When we come back, we're going to turn to the story we were going to start the hour with before that breaking news, the other investigation being led by Special Counsel Jack Smith. This one even more opaque, the one concerning January 6th and the plot by the disgraced ex-president and his allies to plan a coup to overturn the results of his 2020 election defeat. We'll get to that new reporting after a quick break. Also ahead, they've done it to block voting rights. Now they're doing it to block reproductive rights. How Republicans are subverting the democratic process all over the country in an extreme, and I should add, unpopular bid to stop the right to access abortion health care and keep voters from having their say about it. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
There is some other really significant new news in the second criminal investigation being conducted by Special Counsel Jack Smith. According to brand new reporting in the Washington Post, in November and December of 2020, the Trump campaign spent over $1 million paying two firms, Berkeley Research Group and Simpatico Software Systems, to study whether fraud had occurred in the presidential election. Those two firms hired by the Trump campaign couldn't find any, could not verify Donald Trump and the campaign's claims. And when they couldn't find any evidence, they shared that conclusion with the Trump campaign. Today, the Washington Post is reporting that according to people familiar with the matter, those two studies performed by those companies have become, quote, an increasing focus of federal and state investigators in recent weeks. Washington Post adding this, quote, on the federal level, Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith is questioning witnesses about the company's work and has obtained hundreds of pages of emails and research. What prosecutors have sought to show, according to people who've been questioned, is that Trump and his aides willfully ignored evidence in their push to raise money and overturn the election, and that a panoply of advisors had access to the data. The evidence is compelling to prosecutors because it is not neutral or third-party groups saying that Trump lost, but instead analysts whose work Trump's own team commissioned and funded. Wow. We're back with Tim Havey, Charlie Sykes, and Jackie Alamany. Did you have access to these two reports?
We did not. We only knew about one of the two. The Simpatico report came up in an interview we did with Alex Cannon, who was a campaign lawyer. And when he was asked about it, he asserted attorney-client privilege, said, I can't share with you the results of that because it was a commissioned report by counsel. It's an example of a lot of things where we would come up against assertions of privilege with people that knew that we did not have what Jack Smith has, is the ability to quickly adjudicate that assertion and potentially overcome that claim of privilege. So we were aware of one of the two, not the Berkeley Research Group one, but we never got access to either report.
Tell me why they matter.
They matter because they go directly to the president's state of mind. We developed a lot of evidence, very similar to the conclusions that are being reported in those reports, that people looked hard inside the Justice Department, inside the Trump campaign, at allegations of election fraud, and found that they were meritless. And that was conveyed directly to the president. We also, really importantly, we interviewed, I think Jared Kushner actually produced a document that said that the campaign, the same campaign that commissioned these independent reports, didn't just rebut the claims of fraud, but actually explained to the president why he lost. There was actually a state-by-state accounting in this document that Kushner produced to us, which posited that it was turnout in exurban areas, sort of outer suburbs. President really underperformed in 2020 compared to, in those areas, compared to how he had done in 2016. So they didn't just say, you lost because there's no evidence of fraud. They said, you lost because you didn't perform in those exurban areas vis-a-vis your opponent like you did in 2016. So the affirmative explanation for the loss to me is just as compelling as the lack of evidence that would suggest voter fraud. All of that we developed, but we did not have, to be clear, those two independently commissioned research reports.
And did you know about them from your interviews with Jared Kushner and Bill Stepien and other campaign officials?
Or? No. We knew Alex Cannon, the campaign lawyer, told us, confirmed that there had been a Simpatico report. Jared Kushner was asked about efforts to look into allegations of election fraud, and he claimed not to be aware. Or Jason Miller, directly involved in this all the way from the beginning, claimed not to be aware. Now, was that, you know, completely truthful, or were they aware of these reports and did not provide that to the Select Committee? Arguably, yes. I can't prove that. But there were a lot of witnesses, Nicole, that didn't recall things that were hard for us to imagine they actually didn't recall.
So you, let me show you some of what I mean, it's an incredible dual realities, right? Before your committee, people like Bill Barr and others were quick to say that they were standing over here on Earth One. They knew Trump lost and they told him. But facing questioning, it sounds like at least the individuals you mentioned were not particularly forthcoming.
Yeah, there were people that were directly involved in the campaign all the way through January 6th who didn't share with us the existence of this work. You have to be clear, though, that the initial campaign leadership, Bill Stepien and others, were essentially jettisoned, right? It was pretty early, right
because
after.
It came a different campaign. They were trying to win in early November, and then when he was claiming fraud, I think the campaign does the first report.
Yes.
I think Jackie had that reporting. The campaign does the first report to see if Giuliani's claims are true, and the campaign comes back with the comms department, I believe.
Exactly right.
Is that right? And
yes.
They say, no, this is not true.
No. And Bill Stepien says that. He's present at that meeting where the state-by-state accounting, hey, you didn't perform in the exurban areas, is presented to the president. He's jettisoned, and he describes this as team normal versus team crazy. It's team crazy that rushes in and is telling the president, oh, there's evidence of fraud and we have to look into this. And it's at that point that it looks like these reports were commissioned. Let's get the Berkeley Research Group or let's get Simpatico Systems in to look at it. According to the Post reporting, they did that. And just like Bill Barr, just like Bill Stepien, just like everyone who to this day in 2023 has looked at these claims, found that they are meritless. That was conveyed to the president. That's why it's important to Jack Smith.
Is it possible that Jack Smith is as far along or farther along than we know from the outside in revealing Trump's intent in the coup plot as he is in the Mar-a-Lago?
It's hard to say. In a case like this, you want to leave no stone unturned. You want to go to every possible source of information, regardless of whether it might be favorable or unfavorable. You want to scour the universe to get everything. He's pretty far along. I mean, when Mike Pence was in the grand jury, That's not a witness that you call early in investigation. That's arguably the last person that you call before you invite the lawyers to the Justice Department to say, why should we not indict you? So I think absolutely on the Jan 6 case, as well as the Mar-a-Lago case, he's pretty far along. We gave him a pretty good head start, candidly, by disclosing all of the transcripts and all of the documents that we and we articulated a multi-part plan to overturn the election, which shows a lot of evidence of Trump's intent to obstruct that official proceeding. So he wasn't starting from zero. He was starting, you know, from the 50-yard line or even farther. But my guess is he's made substantial progress, and he's also closing in on the end of the fact-gathering phase of that investigation.
Mark Milley figures into what has become public in the documents case because it is a grudge match between Mark Milley, which is some of the, I guess, context for why he's waving around a plan for an attack on Iran. Mark Milley plays into the intent piece squarely on the coup as well. There's a transcript you guys released, like 0 minus 2 hours at the very end. And Chairman Milley is talking about a conversation with Trump. I believe it's about Iran, but I could have that wrong, where it's clear that Trump knows he lost and he's leaving.
Yeah.
How central is someone like that who was simply kind of walking the line for U.S. national security in those final days?
Yeah, very important. Every time there's evidence of the president directly uttering something, it's important. And what you're referring to is that General Milley says he was in the White House after the election had been called for President Biden, talking about a substantial foreign policy issue. I think it was Iran.
It is Iran, right?
And I think Trump turns to him and says, this is not up to me. It's up to the next guy. Sort of an acknowledgement that he will not be the decision maker for very much
because he lost
longer because he lost. So again, evidence of the president's awareness being conveyed again and again by Bill Barr, by Bill Stepien, by others, and statements like he made to Mark Milley suggest that everything he says thereafter is a lie and that an intent to mislead is an intent to obstruct the official proceeding. Again, that's why the special counsel is so interested in that.
Jackie, it seems that what you and your colleagues are reporting is moving questions that we have, again, as a public on the outside about the January 6th investigation and its seriousness and the amount of evidence amassed and the places where it builds on or pierces places where the congressional investigation wasn't able to get, that it's at that point, right, where it's pushing through some of those doors that were slammed shut by Trump's insiders, including these two reports that the congressional committee didn't have access to. What are you guys reporting in terms of both the significance and the maturity of the January 6th probe on Jack Smith's part?
Yeah, Nicole, although I have to be a little bit cheeky and note that we did obtain these reports without a subpoena or overcoming.
Touché.
I mean, Jack Smith has a lot of evidence. That's point blank. I mean, something that I found really interesting, some of these nuggets that my colleague Josh Dossie brought up in his reporting about these both of these reports that have been of interest, not just to Special Counsel Jack Smith, but also to Fani Willis in Fulton County, Georgia, is that some of the asks around these reports, that they were clearly circulated amongst top Trump officials. They were emailed about. One extremely telling and illuminating anecdote to me is that federal prosecutors had obtained evidence from some of the employees who were working for the Berkeley study that Mark Meadows berated employees at the firm after they wasn't enough evidence to overturn the election results and encouraged them to find fraud. So those are the kinds of details, these ones that Josh scrounged up, that Smith is getting to bring all of this to life and to tell a story in order to potentially land charges. But where we are in that January 6th process is still, as Tim noted, a pretty opaque, but they certainly, at least publicly, have been able to penetrate some more walls, in part due to, the length of time, the amount of staff, the manpower, in addition to their subpoena power and some of their legal powers that the congressional committee did not have.
You know, Charlie, the power of all of the evidence that the congressional committee presented, and I won't do it today because I feel like in my control room, they reach for the Thames every time I quote Bill Barr calling it BS. But it was BS, Bill Barr, over and over. Alex Cannon, the campaign lawyer, yes, we knew we lost. Bill Stepien, the campaign manager, yes, we lost. Some of them kind of looked like they were admitting that under duress. But in these interviews, in these taped depositions, they all knew they lost. Now you have the data that shows how they all knew that they lost. They didn't trust us. They didn't trust Fox News, for Christ's sake. They trusted these two private firms that commissioned reports that show them that they lost. It feels like a question that maybe Jack Smith is going to help us understand and answer is the role that the violence played when they all knew that there wasn't a state where you could go and use your fake electors and overturn it because he hadn't lost by just one state. And there wasn't a court case because there were 61 and he lost all 60. All he had was the mob. That was it. And I wonder, as the evidence piles up on the intent and the knowledge of his defeat, and it's really weeks and weeks and weeks now that we know that they all knew they lost, what was the intent of the December 19th tweet? And what did he really want to do by going to the Capitol on January 6th?
Well, that goes to the heart of the whole case, doesn't it? That he had exhausted all of his other alternatives. He tried to get the legislatures to overturn. They wouldn't do it. He went to the courts. The courts recognized that he had no case. He wasn't persuading even members of his own party and his own vice president to go along. So he was left with the mob. But to your point, the amount of evidence that is being compiled here is truly extraordinary. I mean, this is a cascade of evidence. There are tapes, there are videotapes, there are reports, there is the testimony. And as Tim pointed out, we don't know what the status of the January 6th investigation is, but it's certainly relevant that the special committee did give the grand jury a huge head start, and that they did bring the former vice president in to testify, which is something you wouldn't do until the end. So I'm certainly hoping that it's advanced. I'm certainly hoping that they are able to tell the narrative. Nicole, you are a novelist. It strikes me as this is a story that is going to require perhaps many skilled novelists to tell this story, because it is so extraordinary when you tie together all of the different threads, when you link together and connect the dots of Mark Milley and the role that he played in all of this, sitting with the former president and discussing what these war plans are. This is an extraordinary story, and I'm hoping that when all this comes out, that Jack Smith, or who's ever working with Jack Smith, will tell this story. Because you asked the question before about the kinds of indictments. This cries out for the talking indictment. Mm. Tell the story to the American people why this is taking place, what happened. The January 6th committee did an outstanding job, and now it's in Jack Smith's hands.
You get the last word.
Totally agree. We found a compelling story. He's going beyond what we found and is only seemingly adding chapters to the story that are really compelling. Look, just on the record that we developed, we recommended criminal charges, obstruction of an official proceeding, conspiracy to defraud the United States, false statements. From what I'm reading, and I don't know anything more than you do, that showing, that evidentiary predicate is only getting stronger. And therefore, as Charlie said, I think that this criminal process can flesh out the story even more and ultimately might result in accountability. And that's hugely important for the preservation of democracy.
Especially ahead of another election in which he's running.
Right.
It's amazing. It's great to have you here today of all days. Thank you so much. Jackie Elimany, thank you for spending so much of this hour with us and for sharing your reporting on both of our big lead stories. Charlie Sykes, can't do any of these conversations without you. Thank you, my friend, for spending 45 minutes with us. It's too much to ask, but we're grateful. When we come back, we will turn to Republicans, because they keep losing when voters go to the polls to have their say on the issue of access to reproductive health care, abortion rights. So now they're doing something else, whatever they can, to stop those elections from taking place. We'll explain after a short break. Don't go anywhere.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
In election after election after election, since the Supreme Court stripped away the constitutional right to an abortion nearly 1 year ago now, voters have made it abundantly clear that they don't like this. They don't want the government infringing on their right to access reproductive health care. Well, so what do Republicans do? What do you think? GOP state legislatures are now working overtime to prevent voters from having that say. In the latest attempt to do just that, Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey is being accused of overstepping his authority when he demanded changes to the cost estimate of an abortion rights initiative petition from the auditor's estimate of $51,000 a year to $51 billion. I'm not good at math, but that happens to be 1 million times higher. Now, it matters because it comes as Republicans are making it clear that they're willing to lie and subvert democracy to keep women from accessing basic health care and to keep from losing elections. In South Dakota, abortion rights advocates are in a court battle after being prevented from collecting signatures near county buildings for that state's ballot initiative. In Ohio, Republicans are trying to change the threshold for ballot initiatives to pass from a simple majority to 60%. After an abortion rights initiative was proposed. In a closed-door meeting last week, supporters pushing the measure, saying the quiet part out loud again, reportedly describing their campaign this way, quote, you don't say abortion, you don't say 60%, you don't bring up social issues that divide even Republicans. The focus will be on protecting the Constitution from special interests. Joining our conversation is NARAL President Mini Timuraju. Mini, we get to a lot of parts of this story. We don't spend as much time because there isn't always such a crush of public-facing evidence that, one, they know what they're doing is deeply unpopular, even with Republican voters, and two, they are rigging the rules in a way that is unconstitutional, immoral, and I guess courts will have the final say, illegal.
Well, courts having the final say is actually a challenge for us as well, because we've seen they are completely willing, extremists on courts are completely willing to rig that system as well, as we're seeing in several high profile cases. But look, at the end of the day, you nailed it. This is a clear example of how when they cannot win, they rig or change the game. And the Republican Party is masters at projection. You know, they've accused Democrats of rigging the system for so long. They are doing it with total disregard, as you said, to their own base and their own party. We've seen poll after poll, including our own research, showing that even the majority of Trump supporting Republicans are against these bans. So the best we can do is continue to mobilize and try to win these elections. And we're feeling pretty good about that.
The bans, and these numbers just blow my mind. The bans that eliminate exceptions in life of mother are opposed by 93% of all Americans. The bans that eliminate the exceptions for rape or incest are opposed by 83% of all Americans. There's not a ton of polling on the bans that make it harder to pursue IVF or infertility, but that is the real life experience. And then, of course, there are the faces of overturning Roe now. The country has gotten to know Amanda Zarosky and other plaintiffs in Texas. How do you see sort of the ground underneath us changing in these conversations?
So to your latter point, the longer these bans are in place, the more stories like Amanda we're going to see penetrate public consciousness and awareness. Thanks to great reporting like yours and many other outlets, we see an egregious case breaking through the national news on a week-by-week basis. Mm-hmm. And that's only going to continue and make this issue more salient in upcoming elections. The other thing I want to point out on the polling on bans, what's important to understand is a ban is a ban. We've talked about that on the show. Mm. A ban is a ban. And these exceptions don't work for a host of reasons, mostly that they're subject to so much interpretation and there's not clear jurisdiction or standards for how they can be enforced, right? So they create a chilling effect in states for doctors, for providers, and for patients to make decisions unfettered by these biases created by these bans and this chilling effect it has on proper health care. The other piece of it is in the states with these bans, we're seeing hospital closures. We're seeing providers leave states. So even if you're not moved by the abortion argument, which I think most Americans are now are, you are going to be moved by the fact that you can't get access to care in your state because of the way the bans have impacted healthcare delivery in your state and in your region because of these bans.
Right. And I think the notion that doctors and physicians are making plans for the occasion that they're arrested, people to take care of their kids, that women, you know, there now is a politician, as Dr. Oz threatened, in the hospital room or in the doctor's office with a woman and her doctor, is something that is deeply, deeply unpopular. Minnie, I'm sorry this conversation got cut short by breaking news, but we're so glad that we got a chance to talk to you. To be continued. A quick break for us. We will be right back. Finally today, President Biden welcomed the Super Bowl champs, the Kansas City Chiefs, to the White House today. The Chiefs, of course, beat the Philadelphia Eagles in Super Bowl 57 earlier in the year. And that's a reason the president joked why First Lady Jill Biden, a Philadelphia native, was not in attendance for the ceremony. Our thanks to you for letting us into your homes during these truly extraordinary times. We are grateful.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.